Why didn't you tell me about this letter from the bank?
I didn't want to bother you, Bill.
Don't worry, I'm not going to let him bounce. Tomorrow I'll get my bonus. Saturday and Sunday the banks are closed. Monday I'll make an instant deposit. And I've done my share to stimulate the economy.
Hey, this is Dennis Wolacek, and we're here on Legalese every week from 4 to 5 on KFNX News Talk Radio in downtown or midtown, however you want to define it, Phoenix, Arizona, and we're pleased to be with you again. And this week we have a show about banking issues, and particularly with, I guess, a focus on community banks in Arizona and basically whether or not they can survive in this market and compete with the big banks, and what the some of the advantages or potentially disadvantages are to them. And we are pleased to have with us a great group of people here. We have, first of all, Paul Hickman, who's the president of the Arizona Bankers Association with us. And I've known Paul for a long time. And Paul used to work for Senator McCain and was his chief of staff in Arizona, and is a lawyer. And the Arizona Bankers Association represents banks of all sizes and business niches in the state, from the largest global actors to the smallest one-branch rural community banks. And basically, Paul acts as chief spokesman and advocate for the industry in Arizona. Welcome to our show.
Thanks, Dennis. Glad to be here.
Yeah. And we have also with us Dave Ralston, who's chairman and CEO of Bank of Arizona. And we'll talk with Dave more about what his bank does. Basically, as I understand it, Dave has more than 30 years of professional experience in the banking industry and is currently, as I say, chairman and CEO of Bank of Arizona, and has been with that bank in that position since April of 2005, and has overall responsibility for market leadership in Arizona. Basically, Dave has a bachelor's degree in accounting, and he has experience in commercial finance, commercial real estate lending and management, of corporate lending, business banking, treasury services, private banking, trust services, and consumer banking, and is on the board of the Phoenix Children's Hospital. And also with us, and are pleased to have with us Stephen Haggard, who is president and CEO of Metro Phoenix Bank. And Steve, tell us a little bit about your background, because as we were getting prepared for the show, I didn't really have it and didn't want to take the time here to go get it, which we just did compile it. But why don't you tell our audience a little bit about your background?
Sure, sure. Actually, I've been in banking since 92. Straight out of college, actually since 90, in Arizona banking since 92. Worked for the FDIC for about 4.5 years, really where you cut your teeth on the regulations, compliance, safety and soundness, and overall issues in community banking. And, from there on, I went to work for community banks in the Phoenix market. Been with about 4 different banks in the Phoenix market, from holding company institutions to single branch community banks. And it's a space that's a little different than your money center banks or even your holding company banks that may have multi-billion dollars in assets, yeah, whereas community banks have anywhere from 200 to 500 million.
Well, let me be clear on this before we get rolling here in terms of the two banks that you guys head up. First of all, Dave, your bank, where is your bank exactly located? How many branches does it have, and how does it fit into the scale of things?
Yeah, Dennis, here in Arizona we have 8 locations, and we're actually headquartered out of Tulsa, Oklahoma. We're a $24 billion asset company in 8 states, and we entered this market, as you mentioned earlier, in 2005. And we currently provide the full array of products and services that you would expect from any regional financial services company.
Okay, so I guess that's good. In the scheme of things, we have basically what I would characterize as a small local bank, right?
Correct.
And then your bank is relatively small locally, but is affiliated with a larger enterprise, which, of course, today in the banking industry, it's hard to keep track. But I assume both of you, and of course Paul, are well qualified to discuss the issue that I threw out on the table, which is, can a small bank survive in Arizona? And what are some of the trends that are happening with these banks? And let me start with Paul Hickman, who, as I said, is a spokesman for the Arizona Bankers Association, which is comprised of large banks and, of course, medium and small banks. But, Paul, I'm kind of curious in terms, because this is an Arizona show, In Arizona, I mean, do we have the ability of a small bank, in your opinion, to survive and create a niche market, if you will, to compete with some of the big banks?
I think we do. And I think what we have in Arizona is a thriving and diverse banking industry for a thriving and diverse population. We're a very diverse state. And that's what you want. And in terms of banking globally, nationally, and even regionally, we're going through a period of vast change in the wake of seminal federal legislation, the Dodd-Frank Act, and it's going to impact banks at all across the spectrum. But and I want Dave and Steve to speak to this as how it actually applies to them. But I think one of the main issues that the small banks are going to have to deal with in the near future is compliance costs. And Steve and I had lunch recently. He gave me the example. I hope I'm not stealing your thunder here, but he said, you know, I've got 25 or 20 employees, and beyond the standard administrative staff that you would imagine, I want to deploy everybody to leverage money, put money on the street to lending to small businesses. I have 18 or 20 employees doing that, and now I'm going to have 14 or 15 because I'm going to have to deploy two or three full-time employees to just dealing with compliance. That is going to cause consolidation at that segment of the market. That's inevitable. And it is unfortunate because we have about 7,500 community banks in America today, and they're important. And we need to do what we can to nurture those banks and to keep them thriving rather than make it more difficult for them to do business. And
well, let me ask you about that. I mean, the common perception that I think people have is that a small bank will lend to small people, so to speak, to guys like me who run small businesses, and larger banks generally aren't interested in that kind of business. I would like your take on that as to whether that's an accurate perception.
You asking me?
All of
you. Well, let me just. I think that all banks are interested in that. It's just the economies of scale and how they do it, and who can do it better. And I think that they all have their various expertise. But I'll tell you one thing that small banks are in a good position to do is relationship banking. And another example again, steal your thunder, but that Steve gave me that I still remember when I first met him, is he can in a down economy, in a downtrending economy. He had a client that came to him and said, look, I lost money last year. I lost money the year before. This year I'm going to break even. Next year I'm going to break even. The year after that I'm going to make money. Mm. And he started that relationship with him 10 years ago. And so he had to make a gut check decision, whereas if it was a big, large bank, that person, that small business would be a number on a computerized spreadsheet. But to Steve
– Well, let me ask that question, and let me turn to Steve on that. Can that happen today with all the regulations that are in effect? Can you still make a loan to somebody on your gut reaction, or is there so much bureaucracy surrounding the making of a loan today, given all the criticism?
You can do it. You can do it. It obviously is difficult with the regulatory pressure. We've had a rough 4 or 5 years in Arizona in banking. There's no doubt about that. And with that, a lot of our clients and small and medium-sized businesses have had a tough run. But to be successful as a community bank or small bank, we've got to lend money. If we do not lend money, we're out of business.
Right. Well, isn't that true of all banks, really?
Absolutely.
No, well, there is a difference. You look at the big money center banks, the big three in Arizona, B of A, Wells Fargo, and Chase, 75% of the market is what they control.
Right.
They can be successful running at 55 to 60% loan-to-deposit ratios. Community banks, we need to be more in line with 85 to 95%. Loan to deposit. So that means for every dollar that we bring in as a deposit, we would hope that 90% of it goes back out in the street and loans. Whereas the bigger banks, they could take those monies, take them to the trading desk, put them in investments, do some other things that we as small community banks don't have access to or regulatory allowance to do. So there is a difference from that perspective. So we are more motivated to lend. We have more flexibility to lend. And fortunately for a bank like Metro Phoenix Bank, all of our decisions are made here in our boardroom at Metro Phoenix Bank. So,
all right, well, we have about a minute before the break. But, Dave, how do you respond to that based on the size bank you are?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, every bank is in need of loans, and loan demand is down across the country. We're all aggressively pursuing loans, and, you know,
loan demand is down? I don't think people are hungry for loans.
No, it's actually down, and the opportunity to lend.
You're not talking about real estate loans now. You're talking about like business type loans.
Real estate loans as well.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. With the market being depressed in the valley, there's fewer opportunities to lend on sound real estate assets.
Even refinancing?
Absolutely. On the consumer side, I think there's a lot of refi opportunity in the marketplace, particularly with this HARP II product coming out with the government. I think that's a great opportunity to refi. But more on the commercial side, I think loan demand has been down. What I'm sensing is that the market is starting to bottom out and businesses are starting to grow in Arizona again, and the demand is picking up. We were able to increase our loans by 9% this past year. So we are seeing an increase in loan demand.
All right, we're going to come back and talk about that in just a minute after these commercial messages. This is Dennis Wolinchek on Legalese. This is Dennis Wolinchek back on Legalese, and we're here, as I say, every Wednesday from 4 to 5 with different topics every week that deal with your pocketbook as well as legal issues in general. And today we're talking about the banking industry, and we have with us Paul Hickman, who's the head of the Arizona Bankers Association with us, and Dave Ralston from Bank of Arizona, who's the head of that, and Steve Haggard, who's the head of Metro Phoenix Bank. Guys, before the break, we were talking about certain types of things that I'm not sure our listening audience, much less myself, really fully understand that maybe you can help us with. Paul, for example, to start with you, you mentioned the Dodd-Frank bill. I don't think our listeners are really up to speed. I'm not really up to speed on all of it, but why don't you tell us in general, as best you understand it, what we're talking about when we mention that?
Dodd-Frank is the federal legislation. It's the nickname for the federal legislation that's an attempt to respond to the crash of 2008. The 2008 crash emanated from the financial services industry. So generally, banks are regulated at the federal level. That's probably a basic point. And the federal banking regulation has been historically a response to crises. And that's what this was. In our view, maybe we needed to reform banking regulation, but the crisis was so severe that we think Dodd-Frank generally may have been an overreaction.
Mm. So, and what does Dodd-Frank do in a nutshell? I mean,
it does everything, Dennis. Just to give you an example of the magnitude, the last big banking reform act was the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act of the late 1990s, which essentially eviscerated the wall between investment banking and commercial banking, insurance services, and other financial services products. That was erected in the Glass-Steagall Act. That piece of legislation was 145 pages. The Dodd-Frank Act impacts every segment of the financial services industry, even attempts to regulate, bring within the regulatory umbrella portions of the financial services industry that are not regulated, which may be a good thing, like payday loans and such. But it is a 2,000-page bill.
But this is what you were referring to at the beginning of the show when you were saying that, basically small, medium-sized bankers now have to have armies of lawyers basically to understand all this, right?
Right, because of the exposure that it now creates. It merged agencies, created new agencies. In fact, the national news on it this week was the fact that the president recess appointed the banking czar, Mr. Cordray, former attorney general of Ohio, in the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. That's going to get litigated constitutionally. It's not going to be a banking issue. It's going to be what did he have the authority to recess appoint at that time? Was the Senate in fact in recess? Which I don't want to get too far afield on because I don't want to talk about banking. But that gives you an idea of what we're faced with as an industry.
Well, now, having said that, though, the other side of the coin, I guess, is that the public generally, I think it's no surprise to you, probably has a negative perception about bankers no matter what you do, which is part of your job to change that perception. But perception is what it is. So why don't you spend another minute telling us how you go about changing that perception? Because, you know, we asked, I think I mentioned this before the show began, but we asked listeners to email us or on Facebook comments. And, you know, obviously some of them were not flattering.
Right. Well, I'd like to start with the fact that fundamentally banking is a function of facilitating transactions and growing the economy. And I look at it as the cardiovascular system of an economy. You don't grow as a modern economy without a good, evolved, sophisticated banking system. So that's what essentially they do. And Dave and Steve can speak to that probably in more depth. But in terms of what we do in Arizona, we put together some facts, and I don't want to get too in the weeds on it. But in Arizona, this industry employs over 50,000 people. That's 50,000 jobs that this industry provides in Arizona with an average salary of about $66,000. That's a pretty good job. They pay the full boat of taxes as opposed to credit unions. They pay federal and state income taxes. In 2010, they paid $240 million in state income taxes, half a billion dollars in federal income taxes, $135 million in property taxes.
Okay, guys, weigh in on this, but here's where I'm coming from. It seems to me that the banking industry has taken a bad rap in the last couple of years in the public eye, so to speak, because a lot of bad loans are obviously made. I think we all could probably agree on that without adequate a review of who was making these loans. And I think the public perception in general is that bankers may have been too lax in terms of who they provided loans. And now it's probably swung the other way, unfortunately, to where now it's become almost impossible for anybody to get a loan. Why don't you guys weigh in on that? You want to start with Steve?
Sure, yeah. I'd love to speak to that.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I'd like to do, though, is differentiate between some of the players in 2007, 2008 that created some of these massive problems.
Exactly.
The investment banks, the mortgage lenders, the thrifts. We here, both of us sitting here, are commercial community banks. Obviously, we are commercial banks that were not probably underwriting and producing subprime and Alt-A mortgages that ultimately were the
problem.
The problem that, you know, brought the crisis to the forefront to begin with. And so people have a tendency to throw us all into one segment.
I agree.
And the brush is pretty wide. And we have been beat up pretty, you know, severely by this. But, you know, we are still lending. We are still trying to put dollars out on the street. We still have a segment that we approach, and that is that small to medium-sized business owner. When we say small to medium-sized, anywhere from $1 million in revenue up to $25-30 million in revenue. And I can guarantee you, you know, most community banks in town are actively trying to put these dollars back on the street. And so the only way we could change that perception in the public's eye is one deal at a time. I think their decision has been made. Probably the media has driven some of it. Wall Street has, you know, painted some of it, and Congress has painted some of it. You know, this Dodd-Frank bill, this is a punishment to banks in general, I believe. The cost for us to integrate that into a normal operating system is immense.
Well, that's typical of Congress, isn't it? They take one issue, and then they, like Paul said, they overkill, and then they destroy everything. Yep. Dave, what about you? What are your thoughts on this? But, I mean, that's the way it works, isn't it? You know, they overreact.
Yeah.
That's true. It's true.
Yeah, and I would get back to what we were talking about before. With all this new regulation, it is really going to get hard on those small community banks to pay for that compliance, whether they hire it externally or they do it in-house. And that's becoming a bigger and bigger challenge for all the small banks across the country, not just in Arizona.
Well, I got to tell you, I don't know how you guys can really do it, notwithstanding all the public comments. I mean, the fact is the rates are pretty low now. Of course, the rates you pay out are low, too, but nevertheless, they're still low. And, again, if you can't make enough loans to justify your existence, it becomes a struggle every day for you guys, too. I think the perception is just that bankers are, you know, just loaded with dough and you know, being stingy or something. Let me read you some of the comments, for example, we got from some of our listeners that I might ask you to just comment on. Anyway, one listener wrote in to us and said that when the question was asked how secure do you feel about your bank, they said very secure. As long as you're below the FDIC maximum for any one account. And another listener wrote, I feel like a rock star. Last year when I walked in, I felt like a nobody. Now that they see heftier deposits, it's hello, good morning, and people greet me and walk me over to a desk. That's how my bank treats me. And so that was an interesting comment also. And one person said, my point is when working with a large bank, you better have large deposits. You're just a number. And of course, one person said, I feel secure because I got my money in a coffee can. Somebody else said, I went to a local bank, had enough of the mega bank BS and games. Also, being a small biz owner, I'm very big on keeping whatever business I can locally. So that's an interesting comment. And someone said, I love my local bank and my national credit union. And Someone said, I made the switch to a credit union last year, and it's beyond amazing. Great service, stupendous offerings, and unlike B of A, you're more than a number. Let's talk about that last point, actually. Kind of intrigued by this, because I don't really fully understand, having been doing what I do for a long time, the real distinctions between these credit unions and banks and why people would go to one versus the other. Can one of you tackle that, the real distinctions, and what the advantages
are? Sure, sure. I'll comment on that.
Yeah.
I think with the credit union, you know, they do provide a fabulous service for retail customers, for the consumer. And if you want an auto loan, if you want a home equity line of credit, they're going to be hard to compete with. As a commercial bank, though, if you wanted to get a large line of credit or a commercial construction loan or a big equipment financing project, that's where a commercial loan is going to be much more advanced in underwriting that type of deal. The difference, obviously, with them, they don't have a tax issue when they earn a profit. With a commercial bank, we've got a tax issue that we've got to deal with. And so they have the ability to be
able to. So it's hard to compete with them on certain
from a pricing
areas.
Standpoint. That's true.
So you guys have to have a niche kind of to make it. What's in it to your bank, Dave, before we take our break?
Well, we've focused on the small commercial businesses as well. We also have targeted the larger business in the community. And then we have a full array of products. And we have consumer loans. So we're involved in the consumer lending. We have a trust department. We have treasury services. So
pretty broad,
much,
right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll come back and talk about how you compete with the big guys in just a minute. Dennis Wolinchek, KFNX, News Talk Radio 1100. We'll be back after these messages.
You have the right to remain silent. If you give up the right to remain silent, anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to speak with an attorney.
Get me my lawyer!
And to have the attorney present during questioning. If you so desire and cannot afford one, an attorney will be appointed for you without charge before questioning. Now, do you understand each of these rights I've explained to you?
Get me my lawyer! I've been humiliated!
This is Dennis Wolinchek on Legalese every Wednesday from 4 to 5 at KFNX. And we're here talking about banking issues this week and just trying to understand the plight, basically, of banking in Arizona and what it's like now for the banks to deal with all this regulatory scheme that Washington spews out. And I'd like each of my guests, we're with Paul Hickman from the Arizona Bankers Association and Steve Haggard, CEO of Metro Phoenix Bank, and Dave Ralston from Bank of Arizona, CEO, to discuss basically, again, how, Paul, for example, you talked about HARP legislation. What is that, and why is that important for banks to deal with?
Well, I think housing is really where this crisis emanated from, and it was, not to give too long of a history lesson or too involved, but essentially what we had happen was a sort of a confluence of events and a perfect storm. But we had a regulatory apparatus that did not keep up with the innovative financial services industry, and they innovated a new product, the mortgage-backed security, and the regulatory structure did not keep up with it, and neither did the ratings agencies. And there's a lot of institutional investors that can't. Internally, they're not allowed to invest in anything that isn't AAA, and these ratings agencies rated a lot of these tranches of mortgage-backed securities AAA, and we saw what happened.
Yeah.
But you ask about HARP specifically. So in the wake of the crash, the federal government created all kinds of federal programs to try to help people that are having trouble with their mortgage, and HARP is one of them. And Arizona is a hardest-hit state, quote-unquote, so we got another program here. And this goes back to your comment on image. A lot of the borrowers that apply to these programs for principal reduction, they get rejected, and then they come back and say it's the bank.
Yeah.
Well, one of the reasons they get rejected is the GSEs, the Fannies and Freddies, which hold about 80% of the paper, don't participate. But the banks service the account. The borrower sends their check to B of A, Wells Fargo, or Chase. And so they think it's the bank, but they're not eligible for the program. And then the state superimposes on top of that some of their own criteria, one of them being if you have a cash out second, you're not eligible to participate. The bank may qualify that borrower. Their mortgage isn't owned by Fannie or Freddie. Maybe it's owned by the bank, but they took a cash out second, so the state says you can't participate.
But your point is
but
that
again,
people,
it's the bank.
Yeah, people see the bank
they
and blame the bank.
Yeah. Yeah, because that's who they send their check to every
right.
month. So that's one of the trends that we're dealing with in terms of public mm-hmm. image and trying to buck that.
Well, and I think the other thing we were talking about briefly during the break was, I mean, just it's almost impossible today for people to comply with not only those requirements, but just getting a loan today is tough because of all the regulatory requirements. Is that what you see, Dave?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is the opposite effect of what happened before. When people were originating their mortgages before, the banks or the mortgage companies weren't asking for any information. Mm-hmm. They were giving them the loan. And so what's happened is the pendulum has swung. And so now the government is requiring all kinds of documentation, all kinds of support for making that loan. And the consumer, when they see that, they assume it's the bank
yeah.
imposing those
I
requirements
see.
On them. And ultimately, it's for the government.
I see. So that's the real problem. And you agree with that, Steve?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And
so,
it's about to get a lot harder. Let me give you an example.
Yeah.
Dodd-Frank directed the six regulatory agencies to come up with a model mortgage for which you, if you were going to originate this type of mortgage, you wouldn't have to retain any of the risk. You could securitize the whole mortgage.
Okay.
Well, the first proposed rule, it's called the QRM, the Qualified Residential Mortgage, and it's going to require 20% down payment, a pristine FICO score. You can't be late on any bills for like 60 days. That's going to disqualify a huge chunk of our population that otherwise the banks ought to be able to be, Dave and Steve ought to be able to make these decisions. These are qualified bankers with years and years of experience. But
they
ought to be able to underwrite that themselves. Yeah.
They don't have discretion.
Yeah. And make one of those or a lot of those mortgages.
Well you're on a good point there, and I want to follow up on this whole credit rating issue, because I personally experienced a surprise with that recently. It's almost impossible today for somebody to get a great score on their credit rating. I don't know if you've checked yours lately, but it's incredible some of the things that they do. I mean, for example, if you have too many credit cards, which, of course, if you're doing well, every bank wants to give you a credit card. And most of the time people think,
right.
I'm one of them, but that's a great thing. And, you know, you never know when you might need it. So you say, sure, why not, right? It's free.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you do that, even if you pay them off every month like clockwork, they ding your credit score, believe it or not. They do. Did you know that?
No, I did not.
Yeah, they ding your credit score. Because you have too many credit cards. I mean, that's just an example of the lunacy that I saw recently. And so I guess then you take a worse situation, I guess, which is what about people now, and there's probably millions of people now, who are either late on payments, okay, or haven't made their payments at all and are sitting in homes that haven't even been foreclosed yet. I mean, I know people that have been sitting in their homes for over a year, haven't made a payment mm-hmm. on them. And the companies haven't even got around to foreclosing them. Their credit is obviously shot, right? Mm-hmm. These people are out of the marketplace forever, right? I mean, in the foreseeable future.
36 months.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that.
You have a time frame for what Paul was alluding to, the qualified residential mortgage. It's usually a 36-month period of time before they're even going to be considered
right.
for secondary market financing. And so what's going to have to happen in our market?
Does that mean any kind of financing for anything?
No, not any kind. If a bank wants to underwrite a mortgage that they plan to sell on the secondary market, which probably 90% of the banks do it that way,
right.
It will fall into that bucket. However, there will be a niche product that's developed. There's got to be someone to come in and fill this void, alternative financing for people that are essentially in that penalty box and may have had a short sale, may have had a foreclosure, but still would qualify under all other variables. Let's say that's the only thing that they had gone bad for them, but they had a good job, they had a good debt-to-income ratio, they had a stable, you know, history prior to that foreclosure. Those type of deals, in a common-sense approach, should be able to be put together somehow, some way. And there will ultimately be some type of lending group that comes into this market and will fill that void.
I mean, doesn't there have to be when you think about it?
There's
got to
be.
The numbers of people that are just going to be out of the marketplace who have been in default, been late on a payment, given the circumstances of the real world out there.
Absolutely.
I mean, nobody has a perfect credit score anymore. Let me ask you this now.
Excuse me, go ahead, Dave. I did want to go back and touch on the HARP II for just one second.
Please.
Because I think that's a great opportunity for a lot of people in Arizona. And what it is it's really the government trying to help those individuals who are currently current on their mortgages,
right.
but they find themselves in a situation where they're upside down because
yeah.
the value of their house is less
than
their mortgage.
90% of the people.
And so these individuals have a great opportunity because they're throwing out that loan-to-value requirement and basically saying, regardless of what the value of the home is, we will refinance you at the lower rate.
Now, does that include everybody, or is there certain
requirements? Yeah,
yeah, that's the problem with it all.
Well,
you know, people just don't even bother sometimes because there's so many requirements, so much red tape to it. If it's over a certain amount of the loan, they won't do it. They freeze out a lot of people just by these requirements. Nothing's ever simple is the problem, right?
Yeah, no, I would agree with that, but I still think there's a large population base that can take advantage of this refinancing opportunity.
And how do they do that? Let's just talk practically.
Just go to any bank, and actually what's happened is that the first rollout of HARP 2, the refinance was restricted to the individual or the company that owned the mortgage.
Okay.
So, for instance, if we owned or had a mortgage on your home, we could refinance under HARP 2. The qualifications were that I think the loan had to be originated prior to 2009. You had to be current on your mortgage. Of course, it has to be at one of the government loans. And then after March 15th, it's open access. So any mortgage company, any servicer can go after any loan on a refi basis that is HARP 2 qualified.
You know, when I was coming up, people just generally thought that savings and loans, which there were savings and loans in my day. In fact, my wife worked at one as general counsel. But anyway, that savings and loan made home loans. Banks didn't make home loans. But today that's not the case, right?
No.
Yeah. You guys make loans. I want to talk. We have just a couple of minutes before our next break, and we'll pick it up after the break. But I want to talk also about the anti-deficiency laws. I know, Paul, that's a topic you've been talking about to a lot of people, and some recent Arizona law that just came out, which basically extended now the anti-deficiency law beyond just investment property. My recollection of reading this recent case that just came out, I think I saw it yesterday, was that it actually extended it beyond investment property to homes that had never even been lived in but were intended to be lived in. And the court found that as long as you intended to live in the home, then also the anti-deficiency law, meaning the court was expanding the anti-deficiency law. So is this a real problem for banks?
It's a huge problem, and I'll let Dave and Steve elucidate. But just to give your listeners impression of what we're talking
about.
Yeah,
just before a break.
What the deficiency protection essentially does is it says if you borrow money for a home mortgage and the house is underwater and you default on the home, the bank cannot come after you for the difference, which they call the deficiency. They can't sue you for the difference. And the intent of the law is to incentivize home ownership, which is a laudable intent. It has been abused by commercial actors in the marketplace. Spec builders and developers have dumped, 10 or 15 houses back on a lender. The impact that has is it drives up the cost of a loan for all of us that want to borrow to live in our home.
The court basically said that, hey, that's the bank's problem. The bank took that risk, and that given the public policy, the bank ought to suffer for it. That's what the court said.
And I understand that under the facts of your case, the house wasn't even built yet.
Oh, the facts of this case that came out yesterday, the appellate case.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's right. Nobody had actually occupied the home. And that's one of the requirements is that you have to occupy, and the court expanded it. We'll come back to that after this break and spend some time on that.
Okay, that'd be great.
Yeah, this is Dennis Mullinchek.
Yeah,
on KFNX News Talk Radio 1100. This is Dennis Mullinchek on KFNX News Talk Radio 1100, and we're back talking with Paul Hickman and Steve Haggard from Metro Phoenix Bank, and also Dave Ralston is with us from Bank of Arizona, two community banks, I'd say. Obviously not one of the three major banks that you're familiar with, but these are banks that basically cater to customers primarily here in Arizona to be community-based. And by that, I take that to mean that you can walk in the bank and actually talk to somebody that can respond to you as opposed to a machine. Is there a place for your small community banks? Let me start with you, Dave.
Absolutely, and I think where we differentiate ourselves, and you referred to the fact that the big banks have become so impersonal, and so where we try to differentiate ourselves is on service, provide that quality service. Fortunately, in the Valley, and certainly our organization in total is not so large that we can't take care of that client and know them by name. They walk into our branch. We want to recognize them by their name. Make sure we provide the top quality service for that client, whether it's a consumer or a business. And, you know, we kind of put ourselves in the bucket of being not too big and not too small. We're kind of a Goldilocks bank, just the right size.
Yeah, and what about you, Steve? Same?
Yeah, we're quite a bit smaller than Dave's bank. We would be considered a true community bank in the fact that, you know, the dollar size of loans that we go after are going to be substantially smaller. The size of the businesses, $25 million or less. And our investor base and our customer base is exclusively from here in Arizona. Yeah. We are definitely an Arizona bank, commercial bank specific. We don't want to do anything on the consumer side, so we don't have as many tools in our toolbox as Dave's bank does, or especially the big money center banks. But what we do, we do it well, and we do it with exceptional customer service.
You know, one of the things we've been talking about throughout the hour is the perception that people have. I remember a great quote from Will Rogers about insurance companies, but a lot of people applied it to banks as well, that, you know, he used to say that an insurance company is a friend that gives you, you know, an umbrella when the sun is shining and takes it away when it starts to rain. And I think people perceive that, you know, bankers are friendly to you until the time comes when you really need them. And then they're not so friendly. So let me start with the two of you, Dave and Steve. What's your thoughts about that? I mean, you're required to obviously take some actions that are going to be perceived to be difficult for people when things go bad. And you're limited in your range of possibilities, aren't you, by these same regulations we've been talking about? So even if you want to work with people sometimes, you may not be able to, right?
Correct.
I mean, that's the sad part. In that regard, we were talking before the break about this whole concept of the anti-deficiency law, which is sort of in some ways unique to Arizona to some extent. There are a few other states that have it, but the decisions in Arizona have really leaned very heavily over the years toward the consumer, with the Arizona courts basically as recently as this case we were just talking about that just came out, leaning in the direction of saying, look, the banks make a decision. The burden ought to fall on them to, if they're making the decision on the risk, and no one's forcing them to make a loan. And that's how I read that case. And basically, if anybody has to take the brunt of it, it should be them. I think that's just the reality of what you're dealing with today. So in light of these kind of decisions, though, I don't think what people think about is that then the bankers, it gets worse, because then the banker takes a look at these decisions and says, well, wait a minute, you know, if that is true, and of course it is as a tautology, well, then we have to even be more stringent and more careful about the kind of loans we make, right?
Well, and here's what's going to happen, Dennis. I've got a member bank that is at just under the big three level. So it's a very big bank, and they want to be involved in all of these various product lines. And they've made the considered decision, and this isn't unique to them, that, you know what, we're not going to do residential mortgages anymore in Arizona, because the exposure is too great. We're making money doing other things. Now, when you have an actor pull out of the market like that, Economics 101 says that's going to have an impact on price.
Yeah.
It's supply and demand.
Well, that's right. And so people see a decision like that and hail it, but on the other end of it, they don't think of the consequence of it. Speaking of which, I want to ask you guys all for your opinion on this. You know, it's no secret Bank of America recently went through a lot of public relations issues of its own when it tried to, put in some fees for things, you know, and they took a lot of heat in the press over it. But, you know, again, the flip side of that is they got to make a living too, right?
I'd love to talk about that, but I don't want to get too long-winded, because this is an issue that gets me spun up.
No, go ahead. This is on, other guests can comment on it.
Essentially what this is on debit card fees. And what the Dodd-Frank Act did, we come back to that, is it told the Federal Reserve, cap the fees. Okay, this is a free market. The banking industry conceived of this product, the debit card, as a medium of exchange. It is a pervasive product. 70 million Americans use it on a weekly basis. It is safe. It is efficient. It is on duty 24 hours a day, 7 days a week globally.
Right.
But it also is expensive to maintain and deploy. And one of the costs that is a high cost that they specifically did not consider when they wrote the rule and they cut the fees that they're allowed to charge merchants in half was fraud. Fraud remediation and fraud prevention. And let me just tell you what I'm talking about. Fraud remediation. Your Aunt Jenny has her credit card, her debit card compromised. Her purse is stolen. Her debit card is compromised. And she loses all of her Social Security money, which was just direct deposited into her account. The bank holds her totally harmless.
Yeah.
They put it all back. That isn't cheap. The other thing is fraud prevention. It is expensive to stay ahead of cyber criminals. They're smart. And so what we're going to end up with is a less pervasive product and a less secure product at our peril. And people love to beat up the banks on it and say, well, you know, the banks are making a ton of money on these fees. They're not. Their margin is very thin on that. So when they don't, they're not going to make a profit. They're going to make a profit or they're not going to offer the product. But now they're going to make much less of a product, so they're going to cut some of the things that they used that profit for. And besides remediation and prevention on fraud, they use that product for things like checking. And so who does that fall the hardest on? The less affluent and the elderly.
Well, you know, quite honestly, I gotta agree with a lot of that because it seems to me over the years that banks really do not, contrary to popular perception, charge a lot for anything. I mean, even these ATM fees or whatever. I mean, when you think of the service really that you're getting from that, the convenience you're getting from it, I mean, how do they come out on
right.
that? And the money they have to spend for the hard costs of the equipment and everything else and the people behind the scene that you don't see. I mean, it's an enormous cost, right?
Absolutely.
It is kind of an amazing thing. I've never really understood, quite frankly, how banks do make money, you know, particularly in markets like this. And it's got to be tough because the margin of the percentage that you're making on the money you're lending out isn't all that great. And with all the internal costs you've got, I don't know how you guys do it. It perplexes me, quite honestly, all the time to think about it. Here's some interesting statistics, by the way. There are over 8,000 banks and thrifts with more than 99,000 offices in the United States and more than 7,000 credit unions and 5,000 securities brokers, 2,500 mortgage companies, 1,500 finance companies nationwide, 1,300 banking locations in our state alone, employing over 42,000 Arizonans, as Paul said earlier. And basically, banking is one of the most competitive industries in the world. There are more banks per citizen in the United States than in any country in the world. And there are nearly four times more deposit-taking institutions in the United States than in the 15 nations of the European Union, which I thought was incredible as a statistic. So we're riddled with banks in this country. And so I guess that's a good thing for the public. But on the other hand, they have to all be making money to stay in existence, right?
Right. And they're a highly regulated industry. I compare it to the nuclear industry. I don't know of any industry besides the nuclear industry or the banking industry that's that highly regulated. And in fact, they are required by federal law to make money. They're not allowed to be a bank if they don't make money.
I think the bottom line we can all agree is that the federal government, as usual, as I said earlier, took an elephant gun to shoot a mouse. I mean, the problem was real, but it was controlled in one sector.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just dealing with that sector where it was created, again, they do everything by just broad strokes.
And
but you refer to that Durbin Amendment, which is the interchange fees. Consequently, what Bank of America did, start charging that $5 a month charge for a debit card. But really, what did that have to do with the financial crisis?
Nothing.
That's a great point. And just to set the record straight, Bank of America then changed their mind. They reversed course on that.
Yeah, they reversed course.
Not charging that.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. The time goes so quickly. This is Dennis Wolinchek, KFNX, News Talk Radio 1100. And Michael Savage is up next after the news. And we will continue on this topic at another time, and we will talk to you later. Take care.
Thanks for having us on.